From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. First of all, happy birthday to a good old line producer, Tom Danheiser of Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those special Friday into Saturday morning open lines. Yes, here I am in the cave in St. Louis. I'll be here during the springtime. Well, members of the extremist groups have apparently signed up as school bus drivers here in the United States. This according to counterterror officials. Now, in a very caution-type bulletin to police, an FBI spokesman said parents and children have nothing to fear, so that's kind of confusing. Asked about the alert, the FBI said that, well, there are no threats, there are no plots, there are no history leading us to believe that there's any reason for concern, but they did send this bulletin out to law enforcement, simply telling them that foreign extremists have sought to acquire licenses to drive school buses. Isn't that peculiar? And Orlando man who jumped from a cruise ship off Florida's coast was rescued about 8 hours later. He's lucky he didn't drown. 35-year-old man was waving his arms at crews when he was found at about 8:45. He suffered from mild hyperthermia and was otherwise in good condition. A flight was delayed in Israel for several hours after a tiny bird flew into the cockpit of the plane and simply refused to leave. The bird came in through an open door of the plane as passengers boarded at the Ben-Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv. All 178 passengers of the Israeli airline had to leave the plane while the airline brought in a professional bird catcher. But it took him hours to catch the bird and remove it from the plane. Well, honeybees are being removed from this planet, and nobody really understands why. In a moment, our Linda Moulton Howe continues with her investigation into this very major story on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Moulton Howe will be with us for 2 hours tonight. She is an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter, and author, and she has been chasing this honeybee story now for some time. It is a very strange story, Linda. Welcome back.
Well, thanks, George. And, you know, in my previous February 23rd coast, I had news updates about the mysterious honeybee disappearances, mm-hmm. and I interviewed a Pennsylvania honeybee keeper who has had now nearly 2,000 of his 2,900 hives disappear. No bodies around the hives, in the hives, in the boards of the hives, and it is now for him a 60% loss to date. And that was David Hackenberg of Hackenberg Apiary in Pennsylvania. He said that he had never seen so many deserted hives in his 45-year career raising bees, and that it was the first time that he had ever seen predator moths and beetles leave the hives completely alone. And that's why he suspects that some kind of pesticide is getting into the flower pollen and the nectar and poisoning the hives. It's not proved, but that's his gut feeling, and he contacted Penn State's bee experts to investigate. And, George, here we are at March 16th, a little less than a month since that last report, and to date there is no answer.
That's what's so incredible about all of this, Linda. This is going on and on and on, and they don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And, George, the bees are still disappearing. I've been on phones with beekeepers in Texas, beekeepers in Oklahoma, Ohio, all over the place. And as of this month, as of this date, honey beekeepers in the colder latitudes, for example, of Ohio and Pennsylvania, have just begun to reopen their hives, and they are finding continuing devastating losses. Up to 80% in one of the beekeepers in Ohio just this past week. And in the Oklahoma-Ohio area, I talked with a beekeeper tonight. And get this, 13,000 healthy bee colonies he had in mid-November. December 10th, for completely mysterious reasons, his colonies began disappearing. And today, March 16th, from December 10th to March 16th, 96%.
Oh, my God. 3 months. Boom.
96% of all his bees have disappeared. And he told me tonight with his voice cracking, Linda, I'm facing bankruptcy and I'm not the only beekeeper. And what's going to happen? Well, not only is it now 24 or 25 or 26 states, depending upon Bee Alert's map as it goes up and down with new reports in the United States, internationally in Poland and Spain, there are disappearances, and the answers are still unknown right now about how many more honeybees will be gone as more northern hives are opened this spring in North America and Europe. Right now, dozens of scientists are trying to find out what is causing what they call colony collapse disorder, or CCD. And today at Penn State, when I talked with Mr. Van Engelsdorp, who is in the kind of at the center of all this research, he said, this is an emergency. This is an emergency. Now, I also talked with Penn State entomologist Diana Cox Foster, Ph.D., who has analyzed some bees found in deserted hives. And Dr. Cox Foster has seen as many as five different viruses and unidentified fungi in these bees. And she told me that this is at least two times more the number of pathogens than she has ever seen before in honeybees. And the implication is that something has seriously damaged their immune systems, leaving the honeybees more vulnerable to disease than before. But what could that be? So far, there still are no answers, but there is a long list of possibilities, which include pesticides and genetically modified crops, also known as GMOs or GMs. Now, the scientists I've talked to all over the country, they stress that there is no direct evidence that genetically modified crops are linked to honeybee die-offs. But I have been learning that not much is known at all about the accumulating impact of pesticides on insects, animals, and even people. When you consider in this modern world how many combinations of pesticides are now used, one pesticide by itself might not destroy honeybees, but what happens when farmers spray herbicides, fungicides, insecticides, and rodenticides on land that also has genetically modified crops with pesticides built in? The United States grows nearly two-thirds of all genetically engineered crops. Last year, about 130 million acres were planted with GMs. Much of the soy, corn, cotton, and canola have had a gene inserted into their DNA to produce pesticides systemically throughout the plants. And this is created and patented by Monsanto. Monsanto also produces genetically modified crops designed not to die when herbicides are sprayed on them. And in a perfect biotech world, only the weeds would be killed. But Mother Nature has a way of outwitting human designs. And now they're finding that the weeds are becoming resistant to the herbicide sprays, and frustrated farmers are putting on more and more poisons. How much is too much? One American plant pathologist who is very concerned about the herbicide-resistant weeds is Doug Gurian-Sherman, Ph.D., now a senior scientist in the Food and Environment Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. Previously, between 1995 and 2000, Dr. Gurian-Sherman was a staff scientist at the Environmental Protection Agency, where he evaluated risks and safety of pesticides and genetically modified crops. I asked him earlier this week about the possible impact of accumulating pesticides on honeybees.
it's hard to know what the ramification might be for bees, but one of the two main types of genetically engineered crops, and the one most widely planted in the U.S. and around the world, are herbicide-tolerant crops, and especially herbicide-tolerant soybeans. At least 85, probably a higher percentage, of the soybeans in the U.S. are resistant to a particular type of herbicide called glyphosate. The trade name of the most common type is called Roundup. And what this trait does is allows a farmer to spray the herbicide right on the crop, which would have killed the crop, would have killed the soybeans prior to the introduction of this gene. The gene comes from a type of bacteria that is found in the soil, and it makes the plant basically immune to the herbicide. The consequence of this is that glyphosate and Roundup, which is sold by Monsanto, which also sells the seed of the type of soybeans that are immune or resistant to the herbicide, that herbicide has become the most widely used herbicide now in the world. And the consequence of that is you have one particular herbicide that's used on a tremendous amount of acreage in the U.S. and elsewhere, especially Argentina and Brazil. As any biologist would expect, when you have such tremendous pressure on weeds to try to survive this herbicide, some of the weeds that are resistant, all their competition is basically killed off, and these resistant weeds then proliferate and can no longer be controlled by glyphosate. So now you have a situation where the use of this herbicide has gone up, and on probably millions of acres, other herbicides are having to be used as well as glyphosate in order to control the resistant weeds. So what we've been seeing in the last few years is the overall level of herbicide use increasing on these crops, and it will almost inevitably continue to increase. And in this case, causing the rise of these resistant weeds and the increased use of herbicides, and potentially maybe harming amphibians to boot.
And the honeybees. And with the creation of these Frankenstein crops and Frankenstein weeds, isn't emerging a major question about the accumulation that no one really knows the answer to? How much is too much for Earth life, and that the piling on of herbicides now against resistant weeds made resistant through the application of genetically modified herbicides, you are increasing pesticides out there in the world with unknown consequences?
Well, certainly when the Environmental Protection Agency registers pesticides, it does quite a bit of testing. But even though that testing does reveal potential risks and does have a lot of value, it certainly also has substantial limits. And one of those limits is that we really don't often have a good handle on how the interaction between different pesticides can affect organisms. And that's really not considered or tested by EPA.
Another bee expert at the University of California in Davis has discovered that some EPA-approved fungicides that don't kill adult honeybees do kill bee larvae and young bees. Eric Musson, Ph.D., is an entomologist and extension apiculturist at UC Davis. He is concerned that some EPA approval criteria only applies to adult honeybees and does not protect the young.
If you have something like a fungicide which doesn't hurt an adult bee when it's sprayed with it or hits it in the field, then they just think it's safe for honeybees. And in some cases, that hasn't been the truth. Not too long ago, I ran some experiments in the lab and found out that two of the fungicides that are commonly used out here for controlling diseases on the almond trees, if you got too much of it into the larval food of honeybees, it killed the larvae.
And the bottom line is that currently the Environmental Protection Agency has testing regulations that are applied to the adult bee, but you're finding that those levels that EPA accepts are killing the brood and the young bees.
Well, that's only happened in a few chemicals, but I guess the answer to that is yes. And what we were hoping would be that there would also have to be some kind of data generated before a registration was processed that talked about what happened if it got into the food of the immatures.
Now, when you explained the research that you did and what you found to EPA, what did EPA say?
Well, they said they wanted to see some evidence or some data. So I sent them the evidence, and I cannot see that anything has changed since that. And that was a couple of years ago.
In the past 6 years, a new group of nicotine-based pesticides have emerged called neonicotinoids. The most common is imidacloprid. Ironically, these were originally manufactured to be less lethal. But about 4 years ago, French and Italian beekeepers complained that imidacloprid crop spraying was killing their honeybees. So the French and Italian governments banned the nicotine-based pesticides. American scientists now studying the colony collapse disorder wrote in their first preliminary report that even though the neonicotinoids will not kill adult bees directly on flowers and plants, lab research shows, quote, if bees are eating fresh or stored pollen contaminated with these chemicals at low levels, the pesticides might not cause mortality, but might impact the bee's ability to learn or make memories. If this is the case, young bees leaving the hives to make orientation flights might not be able to learn the location of the hive and might not be returning, causing the colonies to dwindle and eventually die, unquote. I asked Jerry Hayes, chief of the apiary section for Florida's Department of Agriculture in Gainesville, about the nicotine-based pesticide's ability to disable honeybee memory.
The interesting thing about the colony collapse disorder is, of course, bees are leaving the colony and not coming back, which is highly unusual for a social insect to leave a queen and its brood or its young behind. So they seemingly are going out, can't find their way back home. The imidacloprid, when it's used to control termites, does exactly the same thing. One of the methods it uses to kill termites is that the termites feed on this material and then go out to feed and can't remember how to get home. And then it also causes their immune system to collapse, causing what would be normal organisms to become pathogenic in them.
Have farmers been using imidacloprid more than they have in the past?
Well, I think a couple things. I think its use has changed. First, it started out as a seed treatment to protect the seed as it germinated and developed. Now it's being used as a foliar spray. It's being used as a systemic. It's being combined with fungicides, which increases its efficacy. And so its use has changed. And especially systemically, it does what it's supposed to do. It takes care of agricultural pests, which we want it to do. But there seems to be a disconnect sometimes that researchers and horticulturists forget that a honeybee is an insect. Then, of course, there are other insects out there that are valuable pollinators as well. So systemically, this material is found in the nectar, in many cases in low doses, not something that would kill a honeybee. So the question is, what does chronic exposure to the honeybee as an adult, or as the bees bring this material back to the nest to store and feed to developing young bees over time, what does chronic exposure do to the colony?
And Dennis Hayes told me that the National Academy of Sciences is very concerned about the decline of all North American pollinators and what could happen to the United States food supply if we can't stop pollinators from disappearing. And he spoke about this before an Academy meeting in Washington, D.C. last year, George, and we'll hear more about this in the next half hour.
Linda, you've covered a lot of stories of high strangeness. How would you push this one into the pile, way up there?
In terms of our Earth and the implications of the pollinators disappearing, George, this is really serious. As this other scientist told me today, this is an emergency.
And you know what? It's such a story of huge scope and in magnitude, Linda. I'm amazed of the truly minimal coverage it gets on a national basis. Local stations are handling this in their particular states. But in terms of this being a major news story that should be scattered all over the media, it's not being done. Why is that?
When the anchors can't get their strawberries, when they can't get their apples, when they can't get the blueberries, whenever they can't get all of these foods that we love so much, then it will become relevant to putting on the 6 o'clock news. To me, right now is when it's crucial, because we're opening up hives around this nation. And if it's going to be 60, 70, 80, 96% empty, George, what does happen in 2007 with our food supply that the United States now is reaching out of our borders?
Linda will be right back with a second part of her report tonight. And then next hour, we'll keep her around for phone calls with Linda, not just restricting you to questions about the honeybees, though that's very important. We can talk about crop formations and some of the other stories Linda has investigated. Well, when we open up the lines in a few hours, just pure open line phone calls, we're going to open up a hotline for you to share some of the craziest things you've ever seen. There's a reason for that. I'm going to tell you about a story that happened in Baltimore in an hour or so. Absolutely incredible. Hey, the After Dark newsletter comes out every month. It is just full of all kinds of great stories. But you will get, for a very limited time now, the clock is ticking, 2 free old classic Art Bell shows with the late Father Malachi Martin on demons, possessions, exorcisms. Take advantage of it. Get the classic old shows when you subscribe to After Dark. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie in the cave for a little bit. Probably be here for about 4 weeks or so. There is nothing like springtime in St. Louis. Linda Moulton Howe with us, as she will be next hour as well. Linda, I'll let you pick up with your second half of your story.
Well, thanks, George. And a follow-up to Jerry Hayes' comments there in the end of the first half hour about those nicotine-based pesticides. There was another important finding about the unpredictable impact that combinations of pesticides can have, and it was discussed in the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group's first preliminary report that was first published on December 15th of 2006. And it said, quote, a study in North Carolina found that some of the widely used neonicotinoids in combination with certain widely used fungicides, such as TerraGuard and Procure, synergized. That always means that two things come together and they create a much more dynamic situation. So that when the neonicotinoid and the fungicides come together, they synergize to increase the toxicity, which means the poison, the toxicity of the neonicotinoid over 1,000 times what it would be normally. And this was in laboratory studies, unquote. Now, that is a hugely important finding because it comes right down to the bottom line of how much is mixing together out there between the systemic pesticides built in genetically in some of the GMO crops, the nicotine-based pesticides that are being used more and more and more all over the world, and all of the others, and that we have layers and layers of pesticides. Well, so far, scientists are in agreement that there is no direct evidence that genetically modified crops are linked in a direct way to honeybee die-off. But beyond the honeybees, George, something is killing all the pollinators, at least in North America.
That is bizarre. And Linda, let me ask you before you continue with your report. The scientists who say that they do not see the link with GM foods, are any of them, if you know, getting financing from any of the companies involved?
It's a very difficult and very, very touchy subject. In the last 6 weeks, as I've been getting deeper and deeper into this subject, I have had some people tell me that they would only talk to me about some subjects off the record.
Oh, my.
I have had some scientists get very angry at the implication that they would accept money from Monsanto or Novartis or any of the genetically modified patenting companies. But I've also talked with people, non-science people, in Washington, in the, we'll call it the agency world of Washington, and they don't quibble. They say that there is no question that there is political pressure by companies that have a huge vested interest in the perpetuation of GMOs and the seeds and the herbicides. Monsanto not only makes the genetically modified seeds, it makes the herbicides that are supposed to kill the weeds in the genetically modified crops. And now the weeds are becoming resistant to the sprays. And you can see what a complex situation we've got on our hands.
They aggressively are cornering the market.
And maybe not to the good of people, plants, animals, or the world. I don't know. And tonight, I don't want to be in any kind of a finger-pointing mode, because we've got a really serious subject, and it's trying to get to the facts and the pressure of facts. What is happening, and can it be changed so that the pollinators and the honeybees, which are part of the pollinators, can come back the way they were just a couple of decades ago?
Absolutely. So I'll let you continue. The company, of course, through its scientists, deny that genetically modified foods might have anything to do with this. Go ahead.
Right. Now, the pollinators, of which honeybees we are talking about at the top of the list, also includes bumblebees, hornets, wasps, butterflies, hummingbirds, and even bats are considered pollinators. But something is happening in the environment that is causing all of those different species to decline. And currently, the most dramatic event is the massive disappearance of honeybees in North America, Spain, and Poland, and we'll see what else happens in Europe as the spring unfolds there. Well, I was talking about all this with Jerry Hayes, who's chief of the apiary section for Florida's Department of Agriculture in Gainesville. And he told me that he was asked a year ago to speak before the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., about the serious decline of North American pollinators.
I was able to make a presentation to the National Academy of Sciences last year, and they produced a report about the loss of pollinators in North America. The federal government asked the National Academy of Sciences to look at this from a strategic standpoint. How much of our food production do we want to turn over to other countries that may be friendly now and not friendly in the future, similar to our energy production problems right now? So the federal government is looking at this, and my question is, are honeybees the canary in the coal mine? What are honeybees trying to tell us that we as humans should be paying more attention to? This is the most dramatic losses that I've seen in my career. I think I've heard 80% losses. I think they lost 400,000 colonies in Poland and 600,000 in Spain or something like that. We have about 280,000 colonies registered in the state of Florida. Of that, we're projecting a loss between 35 and 45% of those. What insects can you think of that man has a relationship with? There aren't too many. And honeybees have had a relationship with man for thousands of years. It has been beneficial to both species. And now that is highly in jeopardy.
Could we be looking at food shortages at the end of 2007?
I suppose if this continued, so then the question is, who fills in the gap and do we become reliant on them? I think I read a figure, the USDA projected by 2015 or something like that, that 40% of our vegetables would be coming from China. So the transition's already taking place, and what does this mean for consumers? If they can still get food in a grocery store and the price is the same, who cares about the honeybees?
But that comes back to your presentation at the National Academy of Sciences and the interests of national security. If we end up losing our pollinators in North America and we're dependent upon China, South America, and other countries that politically may become difficult in the future, what would happen to the U.S. food supply?
Exactly.
The Central Intelligence Agency had reported several years ago that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had a big grip on the honeybee industry in the Middle East and extending to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and that region of the world. Do you think there's any possibility that this honeybee disappearance could be related to some sort of bioterrorism on the part of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
Well, yeah, I don't know if those guys are smart enough to pull something like that off.
Did that issue ever come up on the record or off the record at the National Academy of Sciences?
Not that I remember. Certainly has gone through my mind.
Does it surprise you that since October of 2006, when the disappearance was becoming publicly reported and massive, that there still is not an answer by March of 2007?
Yes. We have a lot of incredibly smart people who know honeybees, who know toxicology, who know funguses and yeasts and what have you, working on this and analyzing this. And I would have thought that we would have had one of those aha moments of here it is. So when you don't have an aha moment, that tells me that it's something so brand new that we can't identify it, or that there are multiple things intersecting causing the problem.
And that's what I think is going to be unfolding over the next at least 3 or 4 weeks. I learned today, George, that there was a meeting yesterday in Washington, D.C. with all of the people that I've had on Coast in February and March, and that they will be joined by a lot of other people, ranging from producers to beekeepers to more scientists. And that they had a meeting yesterday, and in that meeting they discussed that there now is congressional interest in the House subcommittee on agriculture for having a hearing on March 29th at the end of this month with the same group of scientists in the colony collapse disorder and bringing in a lot of other people, and that the subcommittee wants to hear by then what more statistics do they have over the next 2 weeks and be alert. Technologies now has at its website a survey for beekeepers to try to keep on a daily basis all over the United States. They're asking for beekeepers to go to Be Alert Technologies, fill out that survey as they are opening up the hives, those that have been in the northern climes, and to report as accurately as possible how many hives are empty or whatever the problems are, so that in 2 weeks they can present to the House subcommittee, here is what the picture looks like on March 30th. And right now, on the phone calls that I've had today, yesterday, the day before with beekeepers, trying to find out what are they learning as they're opening up if they are in some parts of the country just opening up their hives for the first time, or if they have been pollinators going to California for the almond pollination.
Right.
What's been happening? And I really kind of hoped positively that I would start hearing it's stopping. I'm actually surprised at the almost near desperation that I have now heard in the voices of some of these beekeepers who are saying, Linda, when we had mites at the end of the 80s, and they would describe the situation, and the mites came in, and there was a lot of loss, but there were bodies. There were bodies in the bottoms of the hives. There were bodies around. As the man, one of the beekeepers, the one who has had 13,000 healthy hives in mid-November, he told me tonight, he said, you have no idea how weird it is. For me, he said, I've been doing beekeeping for 47 years. And he said, you go out and you look at the bottom of the hive, and he said, it's clean. Everything is clean. There are just no dead bodies. There's no signs of anything. He said, it's really eerie, and you're left with, I don't even know how to grab at this. Because he said, with mites, we at least were given guidance, and we said, okay, this is the problem. And so now we're going to come up with a way to deal with the mites. And he said, now it's like we're dealing with a ghost. The bees are disappearing, and we can't get our hands on why they are disappearing.
Linda, do we know if the bees are setting up colonies someplace else or if they're dying?
Well, there have been some bees found dead or dying inside of a few of the hives. Like there have been queens with some of the worker bees around them and little spots of bees, and that's what has have gone to the University of Pennsylvania and Penn State right. and other places for examination. But the bottom line answer is, if you think, well, if there were thousands of bees in each hive, and all of these hives are empty, where in the heck are all these bees?
Where are they going?
And why aren't we finding huge clusters of dead bees someplace? Well, this is part of this disappearing mystery. And when I asked, I said, I've been getting hundreds of emails from people all over in Canada, the United States, all over, even other parts of the world, saying, everybody has an anecdote about I've found my my swimming pool covered with bees, or that man who called in February and said that he had put some in a cup. They say they can't use any more samples than they have right now, and that right they are just overwhelmed with trying to do the work and try to come up with an answer. And so they're saying to everybody listening, if you have something, that there are local bee associations in every state. And at my website, earthfiles.com, I will have a report that has all of these links to all of these associations that you can communicate with. And it would be up right now, but I had a server problem tonight, and I was not able to interact with my server. But probably after the show and by the morning, that story will be up there with all of these links. So that for those of you who would like more information or would like to report something, I will have all of these links that you can go to. And another part of this whole story that is disturbing in this sense that I was not so aware until I started trying to find out what is happening in this investigation of the honeybees, about how many layers of pesticides and herbicides and rodenticides and all of this there are out in the world. And that in this layering, as the UC Davis scientists explained, there our EPA, our FDA, and our USDA, and they all try to have standards, and they're supposed to test. And they're supposed to test whether some new pesticide is going to hurt. And then that's the question, hurt bees, hurt what? And when recently, as he stressed, that he in his own lab found that a fungicide that was EPA approved because it didn't acutely kill the adult honeybee, but killed the brood and the young bees, this is a red flag on all of this. How much stuff is being approved, not for any sinister reason, but just the whole overwhelming world right now, that regulations and getting things approved is a big deal. And if they say, well, if it doesn't kill off the adults and it doesn't get into the groundwater and it doesn't, and the list goes on. But what if it's killing the young? And what if some of this herbicide is seeping down into groundwater and coming into taps? Now, this is comes to a story that I got today that comes through the office in an interview with the environment minister in Denmark. And they have just recently found out that water reservoirs are now showing up the herbicide of Roundup that we were talking about earlier.
Oh, jeez, it's everywhere, isn't it?
Well, now, this is really an interesting story, and I hope out of all of this, maybe the bees are going to end up, hopefully we're going to be able to save the bees, and this whole process, the bees are going to save us humans. The Danish minister, they decided that they would do some testing, and this is a quote here. Against all expectations, sieving down, that means going down through the soil and polluting the groundwater, they found at a rate 5 times more than was allowed for the level of drinking water by this Roundup herbicide.
Jeez.
It was 5 times. Now, when we spray glyphosate. Remember, that's when Dr. Gurian Sherman was talking about that in the first interview. When glyphosate, when we spray glyphosate on the fields, by the rules, the regulations, it has been shown that it washed down into the upper groundwater with a concentration of 0.54 micrograms per liter. This is very surprising because we had previously believed that bacteria in the soil broke down the glyphosate before it reached the groundwater, unquote. George, in every direction, things that were expected are not happening the way they thought.
Stay with us. Linda Moulton Howe will now take your phone calls wide open. Conversations with Linda in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie in the cave in St. Louis. We'll be right back.